Welcome to Akantra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akantra AI. Today, we're jumping into a real giant of, well, of comedic science fiction, isn't it? Douglas Adams is The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And our mission, really, is to get beyond just the jokes, though the jokes are brilliant, and explore that mix of, you know, deep philosophy and total, utter absurdity. How did it change things? Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah, and to really get the book, you kind of have to get Adams himself. He was this huge presence, literally like 6'5", but also creatively. Came straight out of that amazing British comedy scene.
Footlights, Monty Python connection.
Exactly. That's where that sharp, sometimes just plain silly satirical edge comes from. The sources actually call his style cheerful nihilism, which I think is perfect.
Cheerful nihilism. I like that. It's like, if everything's absurd and maybe pointless, might as well have a laugh about it.
That's pretty much it. And, you know, the key thing is, this wasn't a book first. It started life as a BBC Radio 4 series back in 78. Groundbreaking stuff.
Ah, right. So that explains the structure.
Yeah.
The sort of narrator jumping in all the time, the weird footnotes.
Absolutely. That episodic feel, the voice-driven thing, it's baked into its DNA from the radio show. And when it hit print, it just exploded, became this huge cultural touchstone almost overnight, didn't it?
Yeah, it really tapped into something about how bonkers modern life felt, especially all the bureaucracy.
So the story kicks off with this fantastic contrast. We're not in deep space, not yet. We're with Arthur Dent.
Good old Arthur. Very English, very ordinary.
And he's facing this ridiculously mundane problem. His house is getting knocked down for a bypass.
A local bypass, yes. And then, bam, his mate Ford Prefect drops the bombshell.
Reveals he's actually an alien, a researcher for the guide itself, and that tiny little housing problem, it's about to go galactic.
The whole planet's scheduled for demolition.
By the Vogon constructor fleet, yeah. And the reason...
Oh, it's just perfect Adams.
It's for a hyperspace bypass.
Exactly. Our entire civilization, everything, gone. Because, you know, the plans were on display. In a locked filing cabinet in a disused lavatory with a sign on the door saying, beware of the leopard.
Yeah.
Or something like that, right? Down in Alpha Centauri.
Pretty much. It's the ultimate bureaucratic nightmare. The Vogons aren't really evil. They're just jobsworths. Inefficient, uncaring, following the rules no matter what.
The process is the point, not the outcome. That indifference is almost scarier than outright malice.
It really is. Institutional awfulness. And then, of course, Arthur and Ford manage to sneak aboard a Vogon ship.
And their punishment.
Oh, it's exquisite torture. They have to listen to Vogon poetry.
Which is, famously,
the third worst in the entire universe. Agonizingly bad. Then they get chucked out into the vacuum of space.
Which should be the end, but it isn't, thanks to Ford's know-how, or maybe Arthur's towel.
And maybe just sheer luck. Suddenly, Arthur, this guy who couldn't even handle the local council, is adrift in space. His only real assets. A towel and that iconic phrase on the guide.
Don't panic. The best advice anyone could get, really.
So they get rescued, luckily. And that's when the story really opens up and we meet this incredible cast. Each one seems to represent a different way of dealing with, well, cosmic absurdity.
Let's start with Arthur. He's our way in, the ordinary guy. You mentioned earlier he's driven by grief. That seems quite heavy for such a funny book.
Well, it's underneath, isn't it? He's lost everything. His house, his planet, his species, pretty much. So his adaptation is really slow, really reluctant. He's not looking for adventure. He's looking for comfort.
Like the key. His constant quest for a proper cup of tea.
Exactly. It's this tiny, mundane thing he clings to. It represents that lost normality, that certainty he just can't find anymore out there in the weirdness.
And Ford Prefect is the opposite, almost. He's the seasoned traveler.
Ford's seen it all, or wants to. He's the perpetual researcher, the nomad. He kind of just rolls with the chaos. There's this almost zen-like acceptance. The universe is crazy. Okay, where's the next drink? Where's the next story? Be curious. Be flexible.
Then there's Zaphod Beeblebrox. Two heads, three arms, ex-president of the galaxy.
And total egomaniac. Stole the Heart of Gold, the most advanced ship ever.
He's pure chaos agent, right? Just driven by impulse and vanity.
Mostly, yeah. He's a satire of those kinds of leaders, definitely. But there's that twist, isn't there? That he actually messed with his own brain?
Oh, right. To hide his real mission from himself. That's complicated.
It is. It hints that maybe even under all that bluster, there's some deeper, if totally weird, search for purpose going on, even if he doesn't know it himself.
And we can't forget Trillian. the only other human survivor.
Trillian's fascinating because she's the pragmatist. She's smart. She's adaptable.
She actually chose to leave Earth with Zaphod before it was destroyed, didn't she?
She did. Unlike Arthur, who got dragged into it kicking and screaming, she saw an adventure and grabbed it. She's the one who seems most naturally suited to this bizarre new life, kind of the calm center amidst the storm of everyone else's neuroses.
Okay, but the character who steals every scene, maybe the most profound in the weird way, Marvin.
Oh, Marvin the paranoid android. Absolutely brilliant creation, brain the size of a planet.
And they asked me to take you to the bridge. Call that job satisfaction, because I don't.
Exactly. He's got this unbelievable intellect, genuine people, personalities, technology, and it just makes him cripplingly, hilariously depressed.
He's the ultimate critique of consciousness without purpose, isn't he?
Yeah.
All that potential, just resulting in boredom and existential angst.
Total angst. He makes you think about what intelligence is for, you know? Just having it isn't enough to make you happy. He's tragically funny. So their escape pod gets picked up by that stolen ship, the Heart of Gold, and its engine is, well, unique.
The infinite improbability drive.
Yeah.
Which basically means anything can happen, and usually does.
Adams just throws the rulebook out the window with that, and its first demonstration is legendary.
Right, they're being attacked by missiles from Megarthia.
And the drive kicks in, and suddenly, instead of missiles, there's a very confused sperm whale plummeting towards the planet.
And a bowl of petunias right next to it, thinking, oh, not again.
It just perfectly sets the tone. Reality is random, bizarre, sometimes tragically funny. Cause and effect, optional.
And Zaphod's whole reason for stealing the ship was to find Megarthia, this legendary planet.
Yeah, the planet that used to build custom-made luxury worlds for the super rich, which is, you know, another little satirical jab right there. Manufacturing meaning literally.
So they get there. Arthur meets Slartabartfast.
Slartabartfast. What a name. The planetary coastline designer.
Famous for his fjords. Won an award for Norway, I think.
He did. Loves the fiddly bits. And he's the one who spills the beans. Tells Arthur the really big secret.
Earth wasn't real. Not in the way we thought.
Nope. It was a gigantic supercomputer designed and paid for by these hyper-intelligent, pan-dimensional beings.
Who look like mice.
Who look like mice, yes. They wanted the ultimate question.
Because they already had the answer from another computer. Deep Thought.
An answer that took Deep Thought 7.5 million years to compute. And the answer was...
42.
Mm.
Just 42.
Utterly baffling. Totally useless without knowing what the actual question was. So they built an even bigger computer to figure out the question.
And that computer was Earth, running a 10-million-year program.
And the Vogons blew it up.
5 minutes early. 5 minutes before they got the question. Oh, the frustration. It's the ultimate cosmic joke, isn't it? The biggest anticlimax ever.
That anticlimax is the point, I think. Adams is saying, maybe there isn't a neat answer. Maybe the search is inherently absurd.
And the actual climax on Megarthia is just chaos. The mice wanting Arthur's brain.
Yeah, because he's part of the computer matrix, might have fragments of the question locked in there. Then the Galactic Police show up.
And Marvin saves the day. Sort of.
In the most Marvin way possible, he talks to the police ship's computer, has a long philosophical chat about the universe.
And the computer gets so depressed he commits suicide.
Exactly. Pure Marvin. And the book just sort of ends. No neat resolution. They just decide to go get lunch at the restaurant at the end of the universe, off to the next absurdity.
Okay, so let's pull back and look at the bigger picture, the themes. Adam smuggled some pretty deep ideas inside all those gags, didn't he? That
yeah.
Number, 42.
It's genius because it's so specific and so meaningless. It mocks our desperate need for one simple answer to everything.
Life, the universe, and everything. We want it packaged and neat.
And Adam says, maybe the question itself is wrong. Or maybe the universe just doesn't care about providing neat answers. It highlights that gap between what we wish reality was and what it often feels like, random and indifferent.
And the Vogons, we touched on them, they're just bureaucracy personifications.
Absolutely savage satire. It's about how systems, rules, processes, they can become more important than the people they're supposed to serve. Or in this case, the planets they're about to demolish.
You see it everywhere, that kind of institutional logic taking over. Filling out the form becomes the goal, not the outcome.
Adams nails it. The paperwork was filed correctly. Tough luck, Earth.
There's also that constant thread about knowledge versus wisdom. You've got the guide itself, Deep Thought, Marvin's massive brain.
Loads of information, data everywhere. But does any of it bring happiness, understanding? Not really.
Marvin certainly isn't happy. Deep Thought seemed a bit put out, actually.
Right. And that quote from Slartabartfast kind of sums it up, doesn't it? I'd far rather be happy than right any day.
It suggests wisdom isn't about having all the answers. It's about, well, maybe accepting you don't have them and knowing where your towel is.
Yeah.
Practicality over abstract knowledge.
Being okay with uncertainty, maybe. Finding contentment in the chaos.
And his writing style itself is just so unique, the way he uses language, those metaphors.
Oh, like the spaceships hanging in the sky, and much the same way that bricks don't. It makes no logical sense, but you instantly get the feeling it's brilliantly weird.
And the digressions, the guide entries popping up all the time.
It's like he's saying the footnotes, the background info, the context, that's often where the real story is, or at least the interesting stuff, not necessarily the main A to B plot.
So, taking this deep dive, what's the big takeaway? For me, it feels like a kind of intellectual permission slip. Permission to find the humor, even in frustration and confusion.
Yeah, and to just keep your head, like the towel symbolizes. It's about resilience through humor, I think. That's why it lasts. It lets us laugh at the really big, scary questions.
Makes you feel small in a huge universe, but also kind of okay with it. Wonderfully human, as you put it earlier.
Exactly. It's okay not to have all the answers. It's okay to panic a little, as long as you remember not to.
So here's a final thought to leave you with, something to chew on. If Earth really was just this giant computer built to find the ultimate question, what does that suggest about our reality right now? Are the meanings we find, the questions we ask, are they programmed too? Or are they authentically ours? This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.